At least 5 Israeli soldiers are injured, 3 critically, in a retaliatory attack by Palestinians after the regime-launched W raid in the occupied West Bank. Iran strongly condemns Britain's meddlesome statement on its latest satellite launch, calling it a sign of London's anger at Tehran's scientific progress. And Afghan girls find an alternative way to continue their education as the Taliban ban female students from attending schools. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, Israeli forces have killed 2 more Palestinians in their fresh raids on an area near the occupied West Bank town of Tulkarm. The victims have been identified as 23-year-old Abdurrahman Atta and 27-year-old Adnan Muhammad Faris. The 2 Palestinians were in a car near the village of Shufa in Tulkarm Governorate, where their vehicle came under Israeli live fire. Separately, Israeli forces have once again raided the Tulkarm refugee camp. The raid resulted in clashes between Israeli soldiers and Palestinians. According to Israeli media, 5 troopers were injured, 3 of them critically. Israel has intensified its attacks against Palestinians in recent months and has killed nearly 250 people, including children, in the West Bank. Iran strongly condemns Britain's meddlesome statement on its latest satellite launch, saying that it reflects the UK's anger at the Islamic Republic's scientific progress. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said London's interfering remarks will not weaken the Iranian nation's determination to break new grounds in the fields of science and technology. He added that achieving scientific and research advances, including in the field of aerospace, is Iran's inalienable right. Kanani said the UK has a long history of taking hostile stances against Iranian people. He added that international laws put no restrictions on Iran's scientific activities, and the country is entitled to use peaceful technologies in its march towards scientific development. Iran successfully launched its newer 3 imaging satellite last week. London denounced the move, saying that it proved Tehran's disregard for international restrictions on its missile program. Political analyst Bruno Baclini joined us earlier, saying that the UK is towing the US line over Iran's recent satellite launch and is trying to escalate tensions.
For me, they are speaking through Washington, provokes and trying to escalate tension in Middle Eastern, and trying to force a situation while watching the BRICS expanding and the Euro-Asian expanding in economics and in high technologies. That's for that. They are provoking. They are bullies, international bullies, I think so.
News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, human rights advocacy groups have condemned Israeli far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir's plan to authorize the use of live ammunition against Palestinian protesters. This after the regime's media reported that Ben-Gvir has already approved the use of such ammunition against Palestinians. Following the revelation, 2 rights groups declared that they would seek the protection of Palestinian citizens through the United Nations and other international organizations. They also denounced the regime's deliberate inaction on the rising crime rate in Palestinian communities, which has so far claimed nearly 200 lives since the beginning of 2023. Back in August, Ben-Gvir said his family's right to safe movement in the occupied West Bank was more important than those of Arabs. His remarks came after recent resistance operations across the Palestinian territory against its decade-long occupation by the Zionist regime. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes, who's joining us from Belfast, and we also have co-founder of the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mr. McNapier, who's joining us from Edinburgh. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Hughes in Belfast. Let's jump right in. First of all, I want to get your thoughts on the recent comments made by this far-right Israeli minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir.
Well, I'm absolutely not surprised by anything I've heard. And in fact, more importantly, it's not his words, but the deeds of the Israeli army on the ground in the West Bank and the continuing ethnic cleansing day by day, the theft of land, the theft of homes, the theft of water resources, and the murder of Palestinians who physically protest against this illegal occupation. I think we are just witnessing a continued further move to the right by both Israeli society, which is represented by the Israeli government. There is already a shoot-to-kill policy in operation. We have seen Palestinians who challenge the illegal occupation shot many times. A knife is thrown beside the body in order to try to justify the murder. The person is then allowed to bleed out. I've seen videos of young men and young women shot by the IDF, and they have refused to allow medical services to attend the scene. So it's very reminiscent of the racism of North America. I mean, we all heard stories growing up, and indeed I'm sure it continues today, where police officers in the United States carried a second weapon, and if they shot a black person, they just threw the gun beside the body and said they were defending themselves. So it's a continuation of the racist, xenophobic aspect of Israeli society, that the only good Palestinian is a dead Palestinian, and Israelis and Jews that live there will only be safe when they have exterminated or expelled the remaining Palestinian population. And the UN will not come to the aid of the Palestinians. Neither will America, neither will the EU. The Palestinians only have their own physical bodies. They only have their own moral strength. They only have the strength of God, and they have the support of the resistance of Axis, the Axis of Resistance. This is all they have going forward to try and protect their homes, their lives, and their families.
Mr. Napier, our guest in Belfast is not surprised at all by these comments coming from the likes of Itamar Ben-Gvir, but it does delve deep and exposes the hostile and murderous mentality of these Israeli ministers, doesn't it?
They are openly genocidal. They openly wish to kill as many Palestinians as possible, and they openly want to remove virtually every Palestinian from Palestine. There's nothing furtive about it. They discuss it openly. And when the human rights groups clutch at straws and talk about the UN being called in to protect Palestinians, it's understandable that people should look for help from anywhere. But the record of the UN in protecting civilian populations is not a good one. And they won't even admit the reality of what's happening on the ground, never mind do something to improve it. I mean, I just happened by coincidence to have been with Richard Falk, the UN Rapporteur for Human Rights, a day that his study on behalf of the UN concluded that Israel was an apartheid state from the river to the sea, that Israel was indeed a crime against humanity. Now, that report was published bravely by some people inside the UN, but it was very quickly suppressed from on high following massive US pressure and threats. So the question of agency is very important. Fraz dealt with it in a sense by talking about the Palestinians have their own ability to resist against overwhelming odds, and they have allies throughout the region. So Ben-Gvir, before he went into murderous politics, he lives near Al-Khalil Hebron. He had a picture on his wall of Goldstein, the Zionist murderer, who slaughtered scores of worshippers in the mosque in Hebron. He had this picture on his wall, and he said he was a wonderful moral man. Now, the picture's gone, but Ben-Gvir has now been put in charge of an armed militia, the biggest armed militia inside Israel, and he's murderous. He's openly murderous. This is only going one way. Now, I have to say two things. One, Israel's always been murderous, but the openness and the kind of blood thirst that you can see at the moment is to some extent new. And Ben-Gvir will not be stopped until a superior force stops him.
Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Mick Napier joining us from Edinburgh, and Fra Hughes speaking to us from Belfast. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review, but stick around, there's plenty more to come here. Moving on, as the Taliban have banned Afghan girls from attending schools, a TV channel in Afghanistan is offering an alternative way for students to continue their education at home. Sahar Afghanistan TV, launched by Iranian Sahar Network of TV channels, has initiated a program to provide education to Afghan girls and boys through their TV screens. We have a report.
This is how Nida and her sister, Zinat, both students of secondary school in Kabul, spend their mornings. They sit in front of their TV and follow the lessons of Maktab Khana, a program launched by Sahar Afghanistan TV channel, affiliated with Iran Sahar Network. Maktab Khana, which means home schooling in Persian, covers different subjects from secondary school. The students can watch the lessons on TV or access them online through the channel's website and social media platforms.
A friend of mine introduced the homeschooling program on Sahar TV to me. Since then, I have been following our lessons every day. It helps us learn from home. Its schedule, teachers, and syllabus are great. I recommend all my peers listen and watch this program at a time when we can't attend our classes at school.
Sahar Afghanistan TV channel says it is trying to fill the gap created by the closure of schools, especially for girls who are banned from attending classes by the Taliban. This program is also said to be the best of its kind, benefiting from prominent teachers, high graphic, and engaging methods.
The Taliban decision to ban girls from going to school not only moves Afghan girls backward, but has also concerned Afghan families. So, as a media outlet, Sahar Afghanistan TV channel found it necessary to provide Afghan students with educational programs, initiating the homeschooling program. It is going to be a ray of hope for both female and male students in Afghanistan.
The program was launched based on a realistic and functioning strategy. The top Afghan instructors are teaching in the program. The best visual qualities and an engaging method, as well as a student-friendly environment, are used in the program so that the students enjoy and like it.
The homeschooling program has received positive feedback from many Afghan students, parents, and educators who see it as a lifeline for learning in a time of crisis. Taliban authorities banned Afghan girls from attending secondary and high schools 2 years ago. Since then, Afghan students have been struggling to find and try alternative ways of learning. In a country where millions of students are deprived of education, Sahar Afghanistan TV channel's homeschooling program represents a ray of hope. Afghan students welcome the program, calling for an urgent reopening of high schools for girls. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Over a dozen people have been killed and more than 100 others, including army personnel, have gone missing in flooding in northeastern Indian state of Assam. The incident happened early on Thursday after heavy rain caused a glacial lake to burst its banks, triggering flash floods down a mountain valley. Floodwater surged into residential areas where several houses collapsed, army bases and other facilities were damaged, and vehicles were submerged. Roads and bridges also washed away in many areas. Search and rescue operations are underway. The disaster, which has affected thousands of people, is the latest in a series of deadly weather events in South Asia blamed on climate change. Munawwar Zamana is joining us now from New Delhi with the latest on the situation that has resulted to the flooding in northeastern Indian state of Assam. Munawwar, what details do you have to share with us at this point in time?
Good afternoon, Bardia. Well, I'm getting the latest reports from the flood-affected areas. Rainfall is now hampering the rescue operations because the main road connecting West Bengal and Sikkim and Assam is somehow submerged, and the rescue teams are finding it hard to continue their operations. But based on the government reports, 14 people have lost their lives so far. Some says 23. So we are still uncertain how many people have died, but hundreds are missing. And more importantly, many security personnel are still missing. There are many trucks that are submerged under the rubble because the lake, once it has blasted the water into the nearby villages and in nearby towns, it's unclear how many people or how many casualties we have right now. But as soon as the rain stops, because that's what's hampering the rescue operations on the way, once that's cleared, once that's there is a room to clear the tracks, clear the buildings, clear the rubble where people are submerged, it's believed that many are trapped. So as soon as the rescue operation starts, picking pace, we will get to know about the actual death toll, but it's a catastrophic situation there in the mountainous region where such events are common, because it's a glacier region, and as we know, the global warming has certainly made some heavy impact on such areas where people live close to the mountains and such places where glaciers are there and places which are cold. So we're still waiting and watching.
I'm sorry, Munawar. I'm going to have to jump in there. We're running short of time. Munawar Zaman, our correspondent, joining us from New Delhi, moving now to the Chinese city of Hangzhou, where the 2022 Asian Games are underway. Iran has sent 289 male and female athletes to compete in 34 sporting events. Our correspondent Salman Kujuri joins us now from the Chinese city with the latest on the competitions there and the medals Iranians have won so far. Salman, over to you.
Well, Bardia, today was a gold day for Iran, a happy moment for Iran, as we had expected, actually. Two gold medals were backed and snatched by Iranian wrestlers in 130-kilogram category in Greco-Roman. Amin Mirzazadeh, after defeating his Chinese opponent, backed the gold medal. Also, in 97-kilogram category of Greco-Roman, Mohammad Hadistaravi snatched the eighth, actually, gold medal for the Iranian team, as we expected. So wrestling brought us two gold medals, and, you know, Greco-Roman competitions come to the end, and from tomorrow we'll have freestyle wrestling beginning, so we expect more gold medals to be backed by Iranian wrestlers in freestyle wrestling as well. Also, today was a history-making day for Iran again, and that is in skating. First of all, let me say that Tarana Ahmadi claimed silver medal, and this is Iran's first medal in roller skating. In women's inline freestyle skating, Tarana Ahmadi claimed silver medal. And another piece of good news, actually, good piece of news is that Romina Solik, another skater, freestyle skater, Romina Solik, has set a new world record in speed skating at the Hangzhou Games, clocking a time of 4.254 tenths of a second. So this is a new world record, and that's a huge achievement and success for Iranian camp, especially Iranian girls, and this time at Hangzhou Games. This has happened. Romina Solik has brought honor to the Iranian camp by setting a new world record in freestyle skating, and this shows how much dedication and also skills she has. Also in skating, in men's skating, we have Reza Silasani, who finished fourth, and Elnaz Rekabi in climbing also made way into the semi-final. Generally speaking, according to the medals table, actually Iran so far by having actually won 8 gold medals, according to the what we have, of course.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hidden Files. Over 80% of the world's population uses a smartphone, but what over 80% of the world's population probably never thinks about is the true cost of the cobalt used in the batteries of smartphones, laptops, and electric vehicles. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi. And today we're going to tell you a story of hands. Hands that have for long been hurt beyond imagination while harvesting the main ingredients to our industries. But before we start today's story, we need to properly set the scene, because though the country we're going to talk about is home to one of the poorest nations in the world, the land itself is perhaps the richest land on earth, or the country in question. The Democratic Republic of Congo, the country with the most abundant resources known on earth, and yet home to one of the 10 most impoverished nations in the world. But it was at the hands of these impoverished people that Europe experienced its industrial boom in the late 1800s. And it all started with some of the same trees that you saw in the picture. The rubber tree. From bicycle tires to industrial bands, rubber played a big role in answering Europeans' daily demands, especially with the rubber boom in the mid-1800s. But rubber does not grow in Europe. And that's where the story of a Belgian king and his Congo comes in. The story about the toil of hands and their unlikely reward. Now, who was this Belgian king we're talking about, and what did he do?
King Leopold II was born to the first royal family following Belgium's independence. He seized Congo with the help of the explorer Henry Morton Stanley in mid-1880s. The king and his forces drained the land of resources, killing elephants for ivory and cutting down trees for rubber. The United States became the first country to recognize his claim to the Congo. Congolese hands were systematically amputated during his rule. The severed hands were then collected and smoked by the colonists to be preserved for later counting and recording. King Leopold was responsible for the biggest genocide in history, with 10 to 15 million killed by torture, famine, and diseases, and many others systematically maimed. The king was honored with Great Britain's most prestigious title, a member of the Order of the Garter, in 1916. Thousands of signatures and recent protests by Belgian people have called for the removal of his statues and the payment of reparations to the victims of the colonial crimes.
The people were clearly being punished for something, but that something was neither negligence nor a crime. Their Belgian masters had decided a certain rubber quota for them to harvest, and they had failed to reach their quota. But it wasn't only these slaves who had to pay for this failure. Let's just say the Belgian punishment system for the Congolese who hadn't met their quota included cutting off the hands and feet of their loved ones. According to statistics, between 10 to 15 million Congolese were killed by King Leopold II during his 23 years of ownership of Congo. And though this number is millions more than the number of those killed in other genocides, few people know about Congo's Holocaust. At the time, this genocide committed by the Belgians slashed Congo's population in half. Imagine that, half of the population gone. But it's best to hear about all of this from one of our guests today, who is a historian specializing in colonialism in Africa.
Prothomeo Gabriel is an activist and a member of an anti-colonialist imperialist organization called No White Saviors in Uganda. He specializes in African history, and with the organization, they have opened a Pan-African library in Kampala. He's also a social media expert and uses this specialty to educate the masses about the true history of Africa.
Thank you so much for being with us on the program today. Can you talk about the legacy of the Belgian king, King Leopold II, that legacy that he had on Congo?
We first have to highlight how, unlike other colonies or unlike other entities that were classified as colonies, Leopold classified the Congo as a private property. It's vast land that had people on it, that had resources, that had landscapes and animals, was essentially the private property of one individual. And With that came his self-imposed right do whatever he saw fit to exploit the people of the land however he saw fit. And the fact that it was private property meant that even the Belgian government, if I may say, at that time, all the Belgian political bodies didn't have a right to dictate or to interfere in whatever decision he took. And we see that with this came a reign of terror for the Congolese people, for the Congolese, Rwandan, and Burundian people. Because when we often talk about the Congo talk about Belgium, we often leave out the fact that Rwanda and Burundi also faced similar atrocities at the hands of the Belgians.
I mean, it's estimated up to 15 million Congolese were killed during Leopold's reign. Do you think that these numbers are accurate?
It could have possibly been more than 15 million. I'm one of the people who believe it was more than 15 million because when you look at the systemic situation as it was, the fact that for every hand that was chopped, it had to be accounted for. Every bullet that was fired had to be accounted for. So that meant taking back the arms of the victim, or the hands of the victim, back to the false public officials. I think that's how the force was referred to at that time. I'm not quite good with my French isn't quite good. But you see that the institutional or systemic system as it was at that point promoted violence against the Congolese people for any small thing. You could have fallen short on your rubber collection and, you know, your child would pay the price or your family member would pay the price. Even you yourself would pay the price. So imagine that going on for years, day in, day out, years. It's easy for anyone to see that 10 million is an understatement.
What exactly is happening today in Congo? Because we see growing calls by the Congolese for the United Nations to even leave the country.
Yes, there are cries by the Congolese population to have MONUSCO expelled. I think MONUSCO is the UN mission in Congo, something like that. And it isn't for, and this cause is for a justified reason by the Congolese people, that throughout the decades that the MONUSCO has been active, they have questioned their input because the Congolese people are being slaughtered. And oftentimes you see that the MONUSCO entity doesn't act, or the UN entity doesn't act only when it benefits them. I don't know if you're aware, but I think it was last year, a UN truck in the eastern part of the Congo overturned, and out of the vehicle came bags of minerals. So for the Congolese people, they are literally tired of being exploited. They're literally tired of this pseudo sense of, we're here to protect you, because that is not what is ongoing. The UN is plundering the wealth of the Congolese people, the wealth of the Congolese land.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on Hidden Files. Though many of the horror stories in Congo's past involve rubber slavery, the oppression of this nation today has far more to do with another type of resource. You see, in addition to its limitless water supply, rich forests, and fertile soil, Congo is home to some of the world's most precious and most used minerals. Congo has abundant mineral deposits of cobalt, gold, diamonds, petroleum, potash, lead, zinc, uranium, copper, phosphates, gold, manganese, natural gas, coltan, and a whole lot more. Congo's untapped raw deposits of raw materials are actually estimated at being $24 trillion. Imagine that, $24 trillion. And Congo is the world's fourth largest producer of copper. Copper that we use so much in this modern world of ours. 60% of the coltan on the planet, the reserves are in Congo. And perhaps most importantly, the country produces 70% of the world's cobalt, which is used in phones and laptops and other high-tech tools. You see, it's the Congolese who are the true owners of the cobalt. It's the Congolese who harvest it with their hands and unsafe mines. And it's the Congolese who suffer all kinds of health issues and birth defects as a result of this dangerous hands-on approach to cobalt harvest. And yet, in 2018, over 70% of the Congolese lived on less than $1.90 a day. Clearly, even though their country is no longer the private property of a Belgian king, they continue to have little to no share in their rich national resources. But how is this happening today in what's now called the DRC, or the Democratic Republic of Congo? Our next guest has some interesting answers, so let's find out more.
Tede Kofi is a broadcast journalist with credits on the BBC World Service and BBC Radio 5, where he presented Current Affairs magazine programs. Tet is a newspaper publisher and ran the Ethnic Media Group, publishing Asian and Afro-Caribbean titles. He has been a crisis, media coach, and consultant for multinational corporations, specializing in the arena of diversity management.
Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. We appreciate you being with us today on the program. I want your assessment of the effects of Leopold Reyn you think could have had on the overall psyche of the Congolese.
The barbarity, the savagery, and the cruelty that Leopold II wreaked on the Congo is one of the world's best-kept secrets. It is estimated that 10 million Congolese died, that he reduced the population of the country by about 70%. In the early days of Leopold, each Congolese man, able-bodied man, was supposed to produce 15 kilograms of rubber per day. If he did not produce that, his family would be rounded up, herded, and killed. And so if people didn't produce their quota, their hands were amputated. There were these bizarre scenes of people presenting like strings of male genitalia, Congolese male genitalia, just to show how many people that they had killed that day because they hadn't made their quota. Now, all of this was covered up by Leopold as an exercise in civilizing the savages, which we Africans were presented as. So he said that basically in the Congo Free State, which is basically my private fiefdom, I've gone over there to introduce them to God and Christianity. And of course, the missionaries were under dire admonitions never to reveal the truth, which of course ultimately leaked, because as slavery was abolished elsewhere, people started to ask questions about how Leopold was running this enterprise. And of course, the whole thing blew up in his face. And he then had to resort to burning all the national records to try and cover up and hide a genocide, which was, you know, in plain view. So again, this is another way in which, if you have lived through that kind of, let me call it a Holocaust, it's probably the greatest human genocide kind of in living memory. If you've been through that kind of genocide, the idea is to instill in the people obedience to authority and power.
How is it, though, that the exploitation of the Democratic Republic of Congo is still existing today, has taken place for so long a period of time?
The oldest playbook in method in the playbook of any totalitarian or any controller is divide and rule. Divide and rule requires that because there are few of the abusers, you must get the people you are abusing to fight each other. As long as they are fighting each other, they cannot unite, because it is only when they are united that they can kick you out of your position of authority, command, and control. And so it is that Congo has always been destabilized by foreign powers and foreign interests who have a profound desire, but whose lifestyles are determined by the cheapness with which they can extract the strategic minerals that I listed before.
Right.
And so that is how it's played out for the Congo. And another way is to make sure that you have proxy governments which are propped up by foreign powers, doing essentially the bidding of the foreign powers so that they can be the natural and easy exfiltration of the nation's wealth to the benefit of the foreign powers. So that's how it's always played. Divide and rule. Proxy governments, which are created by the foreign powers. And thus it has been to this very day. In fact, now there is another challenge because colonialism moved to another stage when, by using local agents, the destabilization could be maintained. And even now, if you speak to any Congolese, they will tell you that the role of Rwanda is a very difficult one in their country. And many Congolese blame a lot of the conflicts, internal conflicts within the country, on the actions not only of the Rwandese, but also of the Ugandans.
Well, why haven't we seen reparations for the Congolese after all of the suffering that they have gone through?
For a crime to be expunged, you need recognition that the crime happened, you need regret for the crime happening, and you need recompense. Now, in terms of recognition of the crime happening, my goodness, if you ask anybody what comes out of Congo, what they'll tell you is Makalele, Vincent Kompany, Lua Lua, and Romelu Lukaku, their top football players. Most people in the world don't even know what the history of the Congo is beyond some trite superficial modernities. In terms of regret, when the tooth of Patrice Lumumba was handed back to his family, here is the thing. There was no official apology, either on behalf of the Belgian state or on behalf of Leopold II, who committed most of those atrocities. So there is no regret there. And as for compensation, well, Congo's wealth is still being filched out of the country on a daily basis. And the parties who benefit from this are absolutely adamant about the maintenance of their profits. So it's a perfect storm for Africa's richest country. And you've got to think about the bigger picture as well. When Nkrumah stood up in Ghana, the independence of Africa was signaled. When Lumumba stood up in the Congo, the independence of the Congo was signaled. And the thing about these things is that they attract people who follow the cause. And so it is important in the interest of the controlling powers that Congo doesn't become as wealthy as she can be. What if then she starts supporting the rest of the other African countries, and then the yoke of colonialism will be broken one by one by one across the continent? If you want to defeat an enemy, you first defeat their champion, and Congo can be the champion of Africa. Just indeed, as Muammar Gaddafi could have been the champion of Africa. Look what happened to him.
Well, what is it going to take, in your perspective, to turn around the fate of the Democratic Republic of Congo?
All I can say is that if people are severely abused over a long period of time, it takes time for these people to heal, for them to find their center, and to make demands based on their own self-validation. So that work has to take place. But that work has to take place right now in the face of overwhelming media coverage, which makes sure that the only things people associate Congo with is Claude Makélélé and Victor Kompany, football players. People don't know outside of Africa the value and the condition of Congo. So all of this applies very, very negative pressure. On the other hand, the international community must write a new set of rules. And that set of rules should mean that all people, as said in the United Nations Charter, deserve respect and recognition. But at the moment, you know, the world is run by what one cartoonist called the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. And so as long as you've got this sort of moral relativism, it's going to be very challenging.
Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Tete Kufi. Appreciate it. But when we talk about the advancement of technology, we often think of prestigious universities and creative minds. Unfortunately, we rarely remember the suffering of hands without whose harvest the main ingredients of advancement would be missing. Hands like those of the Congolese that were cut off for the sake of rubber and the harvest of cobalt. The pain must be acknowledged and the price be paid. But from the Belgian monarchy that has brought about the genocide of the Congolese to the international corporations and various countries that continue to profit from the toil of the Congolese and the taking away of their resources, no entity has acknowledged the crime committed against these people, let alone apologize. Yet even a formal apology can hardly ever appease the victims of such horrible crimes. What good would an apology have done, for instance, the Congolese man who had to stare in shock at the severed body parts of his 5-year-old daughter? I can't even begin to imagine. Well, a true apology must be followed by a change in actions and in reparations, such as those that has for decades been paid by German citizens to those related to victims of Nazi atrocities. Perhaps someday soon, the oppressed nations of the world will begin to have the power to extract this apology from colonial powers of the past and present, but this power requires knowledge. For now, though, that's goodbye for me and all the crew right here at Hidden Files. Thank you so much for being with us, and let us hear from you, from your corner of the world. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers, sisters, listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to the program Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. One of the keys of life we have been discussing is children and our duties towards our children. Amongst the important rights of a child over his parents is to be taught and educated. And when it comes to education, it is not just to throw him in primary school or even before that, kindergarten, and then college, and then university, and then like, oh yeah, I done my job. He's, look at him, he's a doctor. But he's an idiot of a doctor in terms of Islamic knowledge. The Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, even before, and the Ahlul Bayt, they said when it comes to your child, there are specific ma'arif, specific knowledges that you need to educate your child with. Amongst which, first, Islamic knowledge. In terms of theology, in terms of morals and ethics, in terms of reciting the Quran, tilawat al-Quran, in terms of jurisprudence, knowing the Islamic rules and regulations. These are essential for every child, and it is compulsory upon the parent to teach his children these things, beginning with ideology and theology, because you need to make sure that your child comes to this world and he knows who his God is and his prophet and his religion. And sadly, a lot of parents don't do that. They just leave it and for the child for himself to discover. And that's why we have so many children these days, so many youth, I should say, who are moving towards atheism and leaving Islam. It's because their fundamentals are very weak. Their aqid, their ideology, their theology is so weak and shaken that anyone with an ability to bring an argument that sounds firm and strong will shake in their belief. And many children and many youth these days are becoming atheists because they don't have the Islamic background, the Islamic theology, ideology, beliefs, and fundamentals. So it is the duty of the parents to make sure that their kids are taught these things and not wait until he becomes 17, 18, and then he has to go learn himself. This is nonsense. So this is the first thing. Second thing a parent need to teach his children is life skills, and especially social skills, how to deal with people, how to communicate with people, what things a person should do and should not do amongst people. So we need to have a person, a child that knows how to communicate in his own environment. Also, a person needs to teach his children at least the arts and the skills required to defend himself, and so on and so forth. And these three categories, obviously, I took them from the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, not from my own words. So let's look at some of these ahadiths. So these three categories, when it comes to the ma'arif ad-dini, Islamic knowledge, when it comes to the skills in terms of socializing, and the skills in terms of defending yourself, becomes more clear. We will come back.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, he says, من علم القرآن دعية بالأبوين فيكسيان حلتين يضيء من نورهما وجوه أهل الجنة. He says, whoever teaches his child Quran, Allah will give him two garments. These garments, they would make the face so illuminous among the dwellers of heaven. And people would know, oh, this guy must have been the one that had been teaching his child Quran. So not everyone, obviously. Only for those who teach their children Quran on the Day of Judgment among the dwellers of heaven, they would be special. They would be known for that trait. And he also said, إِنَّ الْقُرْآنَ يَأْتِ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ بِالرَّجُلُ الشَّاحِبِ يَقُولِ لِرَبِّهِ عَزَّ وَجَلْ يَا رَبِّ هَذَا أَضْمَأَتْ نَهَارَهُ وَأَسْهَرْتُ لَيْلَهُ. He said the Quran, Day of Judgment, will manifest itself in a form. I'm not sure in what kind of form it will manifest itself. And it will come to a person who's tired, who's, you know, pale, and you can tell he's fragile. And the Quran will take this person and he goes to Allah and says, oh Allah, this is the person that I made him work tirelessly during the day, and he would spend all his night awake. فَيَنْظُرْ إِلَيْهُمَ الْخَلَائِقُ فَيُعَظُّمُونَهُمَا وَيَنْظُرَانِ إِلَىٰ أَنفُسَهُمَا فَيَعْجِبَانِ مِنْهُمَا فَيَقُونَ رَبَّنَا أَنَّ لَهُ هَذَا. And then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would give this servant so much that when he walks amongst the people, everybody will be amazed. And they say, oh Allah, what did this person do to deserve such hefty, lofty reward? And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would say, فَيُقَالْ هَذَا بِتَعْلِيمُكُمَا وَلَدَكُمَا الْقُرْآنِ. This is for teaching your children the Qur'an. وَبِتَسْيِيرُكُمَا إِيَّهْ بِدِينِ الْإِسْلَامِ. And for teaching him the Islamic way. وَبِرَضِيَتْكُمَا إِيَّهْ. Because you have no problem with me accepting him and teaching him حُبُّ عَلِيٍّ وَحُبُّ مُحَمَّدٍ, teaching him the love of Ali and the love of Muhammad, that Muhammadun Rasulullah wa Aliyun Waliyullah salawatullah alayhima. So teaching your children Quran, teaching your children his religion, teaching your children the love of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam. These three, on Day of Judgment, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will bestow so much reward on the parents that the people of heaven will be amazed at that reward. So think of it this way. Not only is it a duty, not only is it a responsibility, but it's also one of the ways that you can make a lot of wealth for your eternal life, is to teach your children Quran, teach them the rules of their lives and rules of Islam, teach them the love of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wasalam, teach them how to become good Muslims, good followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wasalam. There is so much more we can teach our children. All the effort that we put, all the suffering that we go through when it comes to our children in this world, trust me, it will pay at the day of resurrection, the day of judgment. It will be worth it. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's cries.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.